long-term decision. You believe that what happened in the past is who you are. That's BS. Who you are is defined by the next decision you make, not the last one. So get planning. Make your roadmap and take the next step. Skill 2. Confidence. Confidence matters. Confidence is the belief that you can count on yourself, that you trust your gut in the place you find yourself in. It matters a great deal to anyone in business, particularly if your job or company requires you to promote yourself as a way to get to the next level. But it also matters a ton in your personal life and how you think about yourself and your dreams. I don't think we talk about it enough. If you feel like a crappy mom, if you feel totally unprepared to take on your role as a mom each day, how likely are you to enjoy your life and show up well for your babies? If you've always dreamed of doing a triathlon, but you believe you're terrible at any physical activity and are positive you'll never figure it out, how likely are you to successfully take on the next race? Confidence matters. And here's the magic. Confidence is a skill. It's not something you're born with. Certainly, if you were raised in a particular way, then confidence might have been instilled in you from childhood. But if you weren't so lucky, please know that it's something you can develop and that you absolutely should pursue. Here are three things I found make a big difference for building up self-confidence. How you look. This chapter is coming at you live from one of the most highfalutin beauty parlors in the Western Hemisphere, 901 Salon on Melrose Place in Los Angeles, to be specific. As I sit here writing feverishly on my laptop, a team of beautiful 20-somethings are working to cover up my roots and add in highlights around my face. A myriad of tiny bowls filled with different colored potions are spread out in every direction. They're painting color onto my hair with the precision of a pediatric heart surgeon, all while chatting amongst themselves about which house they're renting for Coachella and whether or not Kristen Cavallari's new diet book is any good. Their work is equal parts artistry and witchcraft, and when they finish, I'll look the best I've looked since the last time I left this chair. The entire procedure costs as much as a used Sebring convertible, and that's just the coloring process. I have hair extensions and eyelash extensions, and I got a boob job 5 years ago because I was tired of my post-breastfeeding chest resembling tube socks filled with pudding. I know, not everyone approves of spending all of this time and money on your physical appearance. I know because they send me notes. How can you tell us to love ourselves the way we are, but then spend money on makeup and hours getting your hair colored? I understand that this might seem hypocritical to you, but you may have missed one key distinction. I do believe we should love ourselves the way we are. The way I am just happens to involve fake eyelashes. In all seriousness, I love makeup. Have you ever seen those videos on YouTube where gals do different looks and use 100 different makeups and 14 different brushes just to shade one eyelid? That is artistry. That is a skill acquired over years of effort, and I bow down. When I put on my own makeup, I think it's fun and I like how I look afterward. I don't do it because you think I should look a certain way or because society likes a well-contoured cheekbone. I do it because I like it. I invest a lot of money and a lot of time into the way I look because it makes me feel, well, shoot, I guess it makes me feel great. And when I feel great, I feel confident. Before I dig into this more, I've got to add some disclaimers. I'm positive that not everyone I know ties some of, or a lot of, their confidence into their looks. Some of us were raised right. Some of us had upbringings that said it's your heart and your mind and your spirit that matter. That is how it should be. But just because it should be a certain way doesn't mean it is. If I'm going to talk about what really works instead of what should work, then we've got to be truthful. Every woman I know, I cannot think of one single woman who doesn't, feels more confident when she likes the way she looks. Every single one. Disclaimer number two, confidence comes from you liking the way you look, not from you looking any certain way. I love big hair and eyelashes and shoes with some kind of heel. My friends Sammy and Beans, they love sneakers and hats, and I'm pretty sure they think they look worse with a lot of makeup on. It's not their preferred style. If the greatest makeup artist in the world gave them a full makeover, they would appreciate the artistry, but hate the results. It would actually make them feel less confident because they wouldn't recognize themselves when they looked in the mirror. Gaining confidence from your appearance isn't about having a specific style. Gaining confidence from the way you look is about having a personal style. Do you love sneakers and button-downs? Are you into sleek and straight hair and minimal makeup? Is your wardrobe as bright and eclectic as your personality? Yes to all of it. Yes to any of it. Yes to knowing who and what you are and allowing it to be represented in the way you look. I know there will be people who disagree with me. I know there will be people who listen to this and think I'm being superficial. I understand that it seems vapid to start a chapter on confidence and ground it in physical appearance, in how you look instead of how you feel. But I don't think the alternative would be helpful. At least, it wouldn't have been helpful for me back in the day. I read so many books that told me to look inside or pray or say mantras or affirmations to make myself feel more confident. I did it for years as a way of boosting myself up. But I honestly never felt the part of a confident woman until I learned how to look the part of a confident woman. And the crazy thing is, my version of confidence probably looks nothing like yours. The point is not that you replicate someone else's ideal. The point is that you figure out your own. I wish this were a picture book, so I could show you any shot of me from basically 2003 to 2016. In fairness to the Rachel of the past, I do feel like I've improved over time. But it was also slow going and vaguely tragic, and it was entirely because I didn't know how to dress for my body type or do my hair or makeup. Not knowing how made me feel insecure, but I would never actually admit to that. Instead, I loudly proclaimed that I wasn't that kind of girl. I would swipe on a little eyeliner and some lip balm and throw my air-dried, frizzy hair in a bun, all while militantly telling myself that women who cared so much about their appearance were airheads who were focused on the wrong things. So why was it then that every single time I had to get my hair and makeup done for press or TV, I felt like $100 million? How come I would plan date nights with my husband whenever I knew I was going to have makeup on from a shoot? How come I always felt better, had more energy, and a better attitude every time I felt like I looked great? Because when you like the way you look, you'll love the way you feel. This was a big learning curve for me as a grown-up, and it all started with a boob job. It's true. I did get a boob job. It's sort of a crazy thing to admit, but I'm doing it. I'm sure some of you are like, good for you, girl. That's everyone's dream post-baby. And some of you are like, you're an embarrassment to feminists everywhere. But I did it. And since I always try to be honest about the things I go through in my life, I'm telling you about it now. I guess let's start with why. How do I explain this delicately? When I got pregnant the first time, I had lovely little B cups. I loved them, and they loved me back. After the baby was born, the milk came in, and those lovely Bs became E cups. No, that's not a mistake. That's a cup size. E, as in elephant, as in enormous, as in yowza. So, the twins went from little to big and then back again. After that round, I gave birth to two more children, which means that the whole E for everyone rating, it happened two more times. After my last son, Ford, was born, I started exercising more and eating better, and I maintained a healthier weight, which was awesome. But that weight meant that my boobs, which were already in a little bit of a sad state, became nothing. I don't mean that they were worn out. I don't mean that they looked tired. I mean that there was nothing there. No filler, no cushion. The cup, in this case, was definitely half empty. So where before I never really thought about my breasts much, now I notice them all the time. I hated to wear a bathing suit. I hated to go without a bra, or even worse, topless in front of my husband. Mostly, I hated how focused I was on something so trivial. Dave never said anything. He approached them just like he always had, with the reverence and unfettered joy of a straight man seeing boobs. But my issues got worse. Honestly, I'm not one to wallow for long. I'm a fixer. And while I can't fix everything, this was something I definitely could do something about. I decided I was going to have them lifted back up. I found a doctor who was awesome and who also has kids, so she totally got what I was looking for. I made Dave go with me to the appointment, and I asked a million questions, which mostly had to do with whether I'd die on the table like that mom from Clueless, and whether I'd lose sensitivity, because that might almost be as bad as death. They took some pictures for my chart, which, let me tell you, is freaking abysmal. Nobody needs to see their sad little boobs through the lens of an HD camera under intense lighting. I ended up choosing the smallest implant they make because every time I tried on the bigger sizes, I felt uncomfortable. I didn't want to be someone new. I just wanted to feel like my old self. And as Dave put it when I asked him what he thought, "You're beautiful no matter what you do. Just choose something that makes you feel good." Smart man. We scheduled the appointment for surgery. I was so excited, but as the day got closer and closer, I started to freak out. Not about whether to do it, but about whether I'd live. I had 3 beautiful children at the time, and surgery is scary. What if something happened to me because of my own vanity? Can you imagine what a horrible legacy I'd leave behind? Oh, my mom was super healthy, but she wanted to look good in a tank top, and now she's dead. I made my friends promise that, in the case of my untimely demise, they would help perpetuate the myth for my children that I died in a Doctors Without Borders mission. Never mind that I'm not a doctor. In this made-up past, I was much more valiant than I actually am. The morning of the surgery, I was a mess. I started freaking out as soon as I got into the room with all the pre-op stuff, and Dave had to come sit with me. It didn't help that my anesthesiologist turned out to be blonde, tan, and basically a very, very young Ken doll. Like, whatever age you have to be to have just made it out of medical school, that's what we were dealing with here. His name was Dr. Aiden, he said. He spent the morning surfing, he said. Surfing. All I could think while they wheeled me to the room was, "Oh, precious savior. This surfing child doctor is going to see my boobs." Sometimes when I get nervous, I manage those nerves by talking nonstop. So I was chattering nervously when the model doctor put the IV into my arm. That IV, though I didn't realize it at the time, was filled with some really strong drugs. I remember telling the assembled medical personnel that no anesthesiologist should look like this guy. He was supposed to be bald and 60-plus years old. He should look like Danny DeVito. I remember all the nurses and doctors laughing at me, and I remember thinking, "Shut up, Rach, shut up." But I was too far gone. I could not shut up. The last thing I remember saying before slipping off into oblivion was, "Please, Dr. Aiden, whatever you do, don't look at my destroyed boobs." Not even kidding. And then I woke up, and I lived. I was so excited to be alive that I didn't even mind that it felt like my chest had gone 12 rounds with the prize fighter. Between the anxiety and pre-op and the unexpected presence of a ridiculously good-looking anesthesiologist to make me more nervous, not to mention the recovery time, it was all quite an ordeal. But in the end, I absolutely thought it was worth it, and I still do. Will you think so too? Maybe, maybe not. I understand that not everyone will agree with my choices, but that's okay. The point was that it was something I wanted to do for myself, something I knew would make me feel more confident. I decided how I want to look, and when I made the choice to change something in such a drastic and permanent way, it made me start to consider other things I hadn't before. Remember, for years I told myself that women who cared about their looks were artificial and vapid. But now I'd done possibly the most artificial thing ever. I'd had someone put the medical equivalent of a balloon inside my body in an attempt to feel more confident. And you know what? It worked. I loved my new boobs. 5 years later, and I still love them. But now I needed to reconcile the story I'd always told myself with the new reality I was facing. I had done something purely for vanity's sake, but I didn't feel like a vain person. I didn't sit around all day obsessing over my looks, and I certainly didn't judge people for theirs. So if it was possible to still be the same woman who was so focused on personal growth, on improving what was on the inside, then could it be possible that my former beliefs about how valuable or not valuable our outside appearances are were founded more in my insecurities than in actual evidence? Well, obviously. Our own insecurities on any subject either spark our curiosity or they feed our judgment. We either see the opportunity to grow and so allow ourselves to wonder, ask questions, and do research, or we become fearful and close down the idea immediately. Only an idiot would consider that. Only frivolous people try something new when they're already on a path. Your insecurity makes it so that anyone who is doing it differently than you is an indictment on all the ways you're not measuring up. Making sweeping judgments about others, or more upsetting, about yourself, isn't helping you. Maybe you'll try getting a blowout, or try skinny jeans, or try open-toe booties with a stacked heel, and maybe you'll hate them. But you are never going to know if you aren't open to considering it. If your self-confidence is through the roof, then keep doing whatever it is you're doing now. But if you don't feel good about the way you look, what are you waiting for? Have you decided this is just what life is like? Stop buying into that. Life is whatever you believe it is. So what if you never knew how to dress in high school or how to style your hair? That was a long time ago, and you're not that girl anymore. I know I sound like a broken record, but every single thing you want to know how to do is in a YouTube video right now for free. Curling my hair, putting on makeup, selecting the best outfits for short girls, how to wear white jeans, literally all things I've learned in the last 5 years. Don't believe me? Go look on my Instagram and scroll on back. It won't take you long until you're like, holy crap, what is she wearing? What was going on with that hair and those eyebrows? Go ahead. I give you full permission to creep on my old photos. Just because you used to be a certain way doesn't mean you have to stay that way. Just because you feel insecure doesn't mean you can't make a change. If you don't like the way you look, if you don't love your personal style, then figure it out. Make an investment, and don't let anyone make you feel guilty about it. How you act. About 10 years ago, I was a successful event planner in Los Angeles, and I'd built up a name for myself in the luxury wedding space. I loved the work, but after years of bridezillas and working through every weekend of the year, I longed to grow into the corporate space, which didn't have any of the emotional baggage that wedding planning did. As I mentioned earlier, I've always been in the habit of calling my shot, figuring out my finish line, and then creating a roadmap from there. In this instance, my dream client slash event was the Sundance Film Festival. It was super glamorous and filled with celebrities, and also took place in a really difficult setting. Producing the luxury of a Los Angeles event in a tiny mountain town in Utah that's only accessible by a canyon likely to be covered with snow this time of year, I knew if I could pull that off, it would launch my company into a new stratosphere. Sundance became my goal. So then I backed up from there. If I wanted to get some attention for producing a great event at Sundance, then it needed to be an event that would get notice. I did some research and learned that Entertainment Weekly was the major player at the festival. They threw the biggest parties, had the most celebrity attendees, and therefore got the most press coverage. They were the best, and I wanted to work with the best. I was in no way qualified to do it. Not all events are created equal, and a film festival in Utah is something else entirely. Still, there was no way I would ever actually learn how to produce the type of event I wanted to create if I didn't ever throw my hat in the ring. I went for it. I asked a friend of a friend of a friend to make an introduction, and I finally got a phone call with the events team. I pitched my heart out. They weren't interested. They were very kind about it, but they knew I was out of my league. Like a dog that suddenly decides to walk upright on two legs, just because you might be able to do something doesn't mean it's the right choice. They weren't even interested in having me bid for the job. I was discouraged, but discouragement won't get you anywhere. Every other week for the next 18 months, I followed up with my contact at Entertainment Weekly. I sent her party inspiration and details on new drinks. I told her the best DJs to hire and cute outfits the staff could wear. I intentionally added value wherever I could and never one time asked if they'd consider me for the job. One day, the EW events person called out of the blue. "We need a caterer for Sundance. You do that, right?" I absolutely did not own a catering company, but I had worked so hard to get this opportunity to partner with them that I jumped at the chance. "Of course, what do you need?" This moment, bidding my first Sundance job, is always the best example I have to give when someone asks me about the idea of fake it till you make it. I hate that phrase because it implies you've got nothing else to back it up. There's a big difference between faking something that you have no idea how to do and having the confidence to step into a role that you don't have full training for yet. There's a study that shows that when a man is considering a new job, he will apply for a position he feels he's at least 60% qualified for. His confidence tells him that he'll make up the other 40% by learning as he goes. By contrast, that same study shows that the average woman feels that she must be 100% qualified to apply for anything. Okay, think about this for a second. How on earth can you be qualified for something you've never done? It's a catch-22. You won't put yourself out there. You never try for fear of failure, so you never grow to the next level. When it came to the Sundance opportunity, I absolutely wasn't a caterer, but I had worked with and managed caterers as vendors for years, and I knew what would be involved. I had connections and resources and enough skill with research and planning to get myself the rest of the way there. I wasn't faking it, because it never occurred to me that I wouldn't be able to figure it out if I needed to. I had years of practice to back me up. Certainly nothing at that level, but I was confident that I hadn't ever let a client down, and I certainly wasn't about to start. I would never take money from someone for a service I didn't have the ability to provide, but I also would never have been able to grow my skill set if I hadn't continuously pushed myself to the very edge of it. That single Sundance event launched my business into an entirely new level, just as I had believed it might. I turned that first year as a caterer into the next year as an event planner. Soon, we were producing lounges and events for every studio and brand that wanted to celebrate in Park City. Sundance became my most profitable contract. In fact, it's what paid for the start of the Chic site and hiring staff when I finally decided to transition into this space. So many good things came out of a willingness to act confident even when I didn't always feel confident. It's like anything else. You can make yourself feel anything you set your mind to as long as you back it up with action. I acted confident in what I could do as an event planner, and then I backed it up with research and hard work to arm myself with the skills necessary to pull it off. Who you hang out with. I know I've already touched on this a bit with the whole you become the five people you hang out with most topic, but it bears repeating here. Years ago, my sister had graduated from cosmetology school and was unsure where to go from there. She liked the idea of working in the beauty industry in some capacity, but she wasn't confident about building up a client roster in this new industry, a must for any hairstylist. She tried several different assistant jobs at salons, and while she liked interacting with the people, she was still struggling to find her footing. As fate would have it, an acquaintance of mine sent out an email with a job description she was looking to fill. The acquaintance owned a spa, and they needed a manager. They'd tried several different people in the role, but nobody seemed to be a good fit. I read through the description, and with every passing line item, I got more and more excited. I immediately forwarded it to Mel. "You should totally apply for this job," I screamed-texted her. She still wasn't sold on the job she was then working in the salon, so she went ahead and pursued and subsequently landed this role as a spa manager. She was so nervous that first week about how it would all work out. She was new to LA and still learning to navigate the traffic and fast pace, and like most LA newbies, she was a bit intimidated that she wouldn't dress right or speak correctly in this fancy spa near Beverly Hills. A few weeks into her time there, I received an email from my acquaintance thanking me profusely for sending Melody her way. She could not stop singing her praises as an exceptional employee. This didn't surprise me at all. I knew that my sister was smart and gracious, and I knew she was an incredibly hard worker. What was surprising is what happened about 6 months later. Melody became a totally different woman. She was calm and poised and totally confident in herself and her skills. She wasn't anxious anymore about her new city or her new role or what she would do next. She wasn't afraid to give her opinion, and she didn't worry about what people thought. I remember saying to Dave, "Have you noticed how great Mel is doing? I wonder what caused such a big shift." A few weeks later, I went to the spa she worked at to get a facial, and it hit me. Melody went from being at a school filled with young people who were unsure about where they were going or how they'd make a career to working for a successful business filled with, wait for it, confident women. All day long, she interacted with coworkers who were at the height of their professions. They had to be to work at a place like this. All day long, she helped clients who were successful in life and in business. They had to be to afford a place like this. Without even trying to or being aware of it, she'd absorbed their confidence like osmosis. You want to be more confident? Hang out with people who are. I know that confidence isn't often described as a learned behavior, but I truly believe it's a skill you can learn like any other. Be mindful of the people you hang out with, the words you use, and the way you present yourself to the world around you. Pay attention to the times or the circumstances that make you feel the most self-assured, and then work to cultivate more opportunities like those. This shift in perception, particularly for any of you who are in business, can truly be life-changing. Skill 3, persistence. I've heard a lot of people say things like, "A goal is a dream with a deadline," or, "You've got to give yourself a timeline." I struggle with that idea because none of the success I've experienced in my personal life has been quick. If I had given myself a timeline of a year or even two, I would have given up a long time ago. It took me 2 years to grow enough of a social media following that a literary agent would take me seriously enough to consider my book proposal. It took another 6 months after that to submit the proposal to publishing houses to see if an editor would take a chance on a cookbook deal. It was 18 more months before that book hit the market. So much work was necessary just to get to that place. I posted a couple of pictures on Instagram recently. The first picture was from my very first TV segment for the local morning news. I had pitched for months and finally gotten booked for a segment on National Junk Food Day, wherein the KTLA Morning News team and I tried out the weirdest junk food on the market at that point. Think deep-fried Oreos and pickles brined in cherry Kool-Aid. Peabody material it was not. The second picture I shared was from my very first time on the Today Show. In it, I'm filling in a Hoda and Kathy Lee sandwich, and I'm smiling so big and brightly that my face is about to crack in half. I was ecstatic that day because I had always, always wanted to be booked for a segment on the Today Show. What I need to point out, besides the fact that my hair looked so much better after I started going to a real colorist instead of using dye from a box, is that the first picture is from 2010, and the second photo is from 2018. 8 years, you guys. It took me 8 years to achieve that goal, and the road was long and hard. It started with that first junk food segment, and after that, I begged, borrowed, and stole to land more opportunities. I would snag a 4th of July barbecue segment here or a Thanksgiving Day segment there. At the time, I was flying solo at work, which meant that every single time I convinced someone to have me on their show, I had to find a way to make it work with no money and no help. I could only buy props that I could easily hide the price tag for so I could return them after the show. I would buy, haul, design, set, straighten, and clean up all by myself. I changed from setup clothes to on-air clothes in gross bathroom stalls or in the backseat of my car. Local news shows don't tend to have the nicest accommodations. Usually, by that point, I would have sweat off all my makeup and my hair would be a frizzy mess. I wasn't cute, but my table was, and I was always prepared to give the funniest, most informative segments they'd ever seen on everything from St. Patrick's to Arbor Day. Going after that kind of press all by myself sucked, but I didn't have the money for a publicist or a designer or even an assistant to help me set it up. What I did know was my goal, and I understood that hard work was the only leverage I had. When I got my first chance to do a national show, I jumped at it, even though it was on a topic I didn't know and had to research long and hard just to be able to talk about it intelligently for 6 minutes. For years, I built relationships with TV producers. I pitched hundreds of segments that got rejected for every one that got accepted. I became known as a pinch hitter. I was the person who would jump on a plane last minute and cover if someone else got sick. If you needed an expert to show up and talk about literally anything, I was your girl. I worked my butt off, and it still took 8 years. It took me 6 books and 5 years to finally get a bestseller. It took me 8 years to get on the Today Show. It took me 4 years and thousands of photos on Instagram to get to 100,000 followers. I could keep listing things out for you one after another of how long it has all taken to get from there to here. But the point is this. It never went as fast as I wanted it to, and if I had given up because I hadn't achieved my goals by a certain date, I wouldn't have achieved any of the things you know me for today. For all my dreamers, for all my hustlers, for all my girls listening to this who are building and planning, don't you dare compare your beginning with someone else's middle. Don't you dare listen when someone tells you that you need to have an end date. Your mile markers, remember, those are the things you can control. Those should have dates attached so that you're being productive and efficient. But your guideposts? Those are more nebulous and harder to achieve, and you may have to come at them 6 ways before you find something that will help you break through. It's easy to see someone else's success and be discouraged by it, because we assume that our first attempts won't measure up. Of course they won't. None of my success has been a meteoric rise. What you see now is over a decade of hard work and focus and standing back up every time I got knocked down. You don't have connections or money or access. I didn't either. I had work ethic and a dream and the patience and perseverance to see it through. It's going to be a journey, and you're going to have to fight to get where you want to go. But it's also going to be worth it. One of my favorite signs I ever saw during a half marathon was a poster that read, "If it was easy, everyone would do it." I love the reminder that achieving a goal is hard, but I'm still here. So are you. The reason that we're willing to stay on the road, to keep pushing to get to the next level, is that we're not like everyone else. It's not easy to achieve a goal. It's tough. But girl, so are you. The reason people give up or fall off or aren't willing to keep moving forward is because they believe this goal that they're chasing is temporary. This is something that we have been sold by media for most of our lives. Try this. Now try that. Now do this diet. Now try this exercise. Now do this thing. Now keep switching. Now keep changing. This type of behavior isn't effective in the pursuit of an achievement. This type of behavior is only effective as a means of confusion. Because here's the deal. If brands and media and the news can confuse you, they can sell you more stuff. Think about it. 50 years ago, the only way to lose weight was simple. Burn off more calories than you consume. It's a simple solution that works. Is it easy? No way. The waffle fries at Chick-fil-A are delicious and way more fun to eat than broccoli. But the diet industry wouldn't exist if the answer was simple and straightforward. So instead, we've been bombarded with a million different answers, all of which are confusing. Should you go paleo or Whole30 or Atkins or South Beach or vegan or gluten-free? Each season there is something new and different to try, and every single one of them is attached to something you can buy. Books, powders, frozen meals, plans, programs, pills, etc. All to answer the confusion you feel about diet and weight loss. This is only one industry, you guys. This attitude of flitting from one possible solution to another like a drunk butterfly shows up in every single kind of consumer good. Is it any wonder that you're trying to achieve your answer, your goal, by trying something for a little while, then giving up when it doesn't work, and trying something else? Is it any wonder you're not making the headway you want to make? No. You believe this goal in your life is temporary. You believe it's something to be pulled on and off like your favorite hoodie. There when you want it, and tucked away in the closet when you don't. This goal, this mission of yours, this dream, this place that you're headed, this is not a temporary thing. This is not something that you're going to do for this month or this season or just this year. Really, truly chasing down a goal changes not just that specific aspect of your life, but how you approach life on the whole, forever. If you're saving money to buy a house, that will require a total change in the way you spend and save. If you want to have a strong, outstanding marriage, that means rooting out any misconceptions you have about relationships and intentionally pursuing it every day. No matter what it is you're chasing down, you'll only catch it if you go all in. This is not just a thing you do. This is who you are now, forever and ever, amen. This is not training just for this month or a season. Think about it. Every professional athlete, every Olympian, Tom Brady or Serena Williams or Messi, they're training just as hard today as they were when they started. In fact, I'd argue that to operate at the level of excellence they're at today, they're training harder than ever before. The training never stops. Because after you achieve this goal, you're going to choose the next and the next and the one after that. You pursuing the best version of you, whatever this looks like, will permeate every area of your life. So stop thinking small. Stop thinking about this with such a limited perspective. Assuming what you're doing is only about what's in front of you now. Dig in. Work hard. Be patient. The time will pass by no matter what. You may as well spend it in pursuit of something more, no matter how long it takes you to get there. Skill 4. Effectiveness. When I'm on deadline for a book, like right now, I spend huge chunks of my typical workday away from my team so I can work without being disturbed. On this particular day, I'm sitting at one of those long communal wooden tables that seem to be required furniture in any respectable hipster eatery. I like sitting at the communal table because I can always find someone to watch my stuff while I go to the bathroom for the 87th time this hour. The only drawback is the constant stream of people who come and go from the chairs around me, making the energy shift and change with each new addition. The first girl who sat down today was here to work on homework. I know this because her textbook was open and she had a worksheet in front of her. She tackled it like this. She read a little bit from the book, then she looked at her Instagram for a while, then she took a picture of her coffee and her homework and posted it on Instagram. It took her another half hour to find just the right filter on VSCO. After that, she focused in on the work again. She was doodling in the margin a second later. Then it was more scrolling and some Googling, and a while later she packed up to go. Not one single thing filled out on the worksheet she came to do. The next person who sat down beside me was a bro. He was here with another bro. I actually like these kinds of dudes a lot. They're in their late 20s, full of energy and enthusiasm, and they quote Gary Vee like it's gospel. I get it. I'm in. Gary Vaynerchuk is my preacher too. In a nerdy sort of way, I was happy they were beside me. They had fancy laptops and yellow notepads, and they were brainstorming and ready to begin their work. After their initial chat, they proceeded to spend 2 hours, I swear, on my unsweetened chai tea, scrolling Instagram as well. The irony that was fully lost on them was that they were scrolling their favorite entrepreneurial feeds, showing each other quotes about perseverance and hustle, all the while oblivious to the time they were wasting. I always feel so bad when I observe this happening to the dreamers around me. It's too easy to fall into time wasters and busy work that get you nowhere closer to your goal. I used to do this all the time when I was a young author. Back then, I had a really bad habit of rereading what I had written over and over and over. I would sit down to write for an hour and spend 45 minutes reading what I had already written and inevitably editing it as I went along. For months, I couldn't figure out why I wasn't making any real tangible progress toward getting to my final word count. I wasn't getting anywhere because I wasn't actually doing any new work. I was just like the bros sitting next to me at the coffee shop. My guess is that they'll have all sorts of collab sessions like the one they had today and finally give up on the idea they're pursuing because it's not getting anywhere. If they're anything like I was, they won't even realize that it's not the idea's fault that nothing happened. It's their own. Have you ever worked on a goal, putting in all kinds of hours and not made any tangible progress? My guess is it was because you didn't understand what to focus on. You thought what you needed was the time to pursue your dream, when really what you needed was to use the time you do have in an impactful way, to help you not fall into the trap of distraction disguised as productivity. Here's every single thing I can think of that I've taught myself over the last decade to be not just productive, but highly productive. 1. Replace your to-do list with a results list. Remember in the last chapter when I talked about creating your roadmap? I mean, of course you do. That was like 5 minutes ago. But on the off chance that you're like Drew Barrymore in 50 First Dates and your memory is faulty, I'll remind you that your roadmap to your goal includes mile markers along the way. These are the stepping stones that you use to keep you focused in the direction you're headed. In order to work effectively, you need to always be working toward your next mile marker. The problem is, like those guys at the coffee shop or me in my early days of writing, it can often feel like you're working toward your next mile marker when really you're just making wider and wider circles around your current location. So, to counteract this tendency, when you sit down to work from now until forever, I want you to stop making to-do lists. The average woman's to-do list is approximately 319 items long, which means you're never going to get through it anyway. Also, if you're anything like me back in the day, you'll spend your entire work time doing the easiest items on your to-do list simply so you can have some items crossed out. But since none of those items get you anywhere closer to your next mile marker, it's all a big waste of time. So let's let go of the idea of a to-do list and focus instead on creating a results list. And by result, I mean, what is the end result I'm looking for from this work session? A to-do list might have a line item that says, work on manuscript. But that's so nebulous. That could mean anything. And if you're already struggling to be productive, your brain will seize on any excuse to mark something as complete. So if I daydream about a title for this book, is that working on the manuscript? If I rewrite a paragraph 4 times, is that working on the manuscript? If I go to drinks with a fellow author and we discuss plot points, is that working on the manuscript? No. None of it counts as working on the manuscript when what I really need is to get closer to turning in this book on time. Right now, the only thing that matters is word count. Right now, I need to spend every waking minute building one sentence on top of another in order to turn this in on time. So, on my results list, I will list, write 2,500 words. That's the result I want. There's no way to sort of write 2,500 words. You either do it or you don't. And P.S., for all my fellow writers who dream of having a completed nonfiction manuscript, having a mile marker of write 2,500 words 26 times would get you there. Let's say you've decided to set and achieve a new target for your direct sales organization. Your to-do list could have hit new sales target on it. But that's so open-ended. I mean, how in the world is that any direction or focus for your brain? If I talk to 3 new prospective clients, does that count? If I spend an hour researching how to grow in a sales organization, is that good enough? Maybe if you're just trying to stay up to date in your industry, but if you want to get something you've never had, you've got to do things you've never done. Your results list should be specific. Reach out to 100 new prospective clients every day, or close 4 new contracts every week, or increase the average sale per existing customer by 3% to raise overall revenue numbers. Notice with that last one, it's very focused. I like results that are specific and about more than the goal, that are also about expanding on ways to achieve the same outcome. If the last time I tried to increase my business, I focused only on locking in new customers and it was difficult, I can step back and ask myself if there's a smarter way to achieve the same outcome. For instance, I could look at doing more with the clients I do have. Could I send out more emails? Can I create a process to make it easier to sell? Can I be more intentional about upselling to increase overall revenue without having to add a new client base? In this instance, my goal is actually increased revenue, but I've gotten so bogged down in my to-do list that I haven't stopped to consider it in a different light. If I don't write down the result that I'm looking for first, my brain can't help me ask the right questions to get me closer to my actual goal. So make a results list, not a to-do list. That daily results list should never be longer than 5 bullet points. In fact, my daily results list is typically only 2 or 3 points long at most. Because the items I'm writing down are major moves for me, when I'm able to knock out even one of them, I feel ecstatic. If you overwhelm your list, you're going to end every single working period feeling like you didn't accomplish much. When in reality, if you've completed at least one ideal result that pushes you closer to the next mile marker, you are wildly accomplished. That feeling of wild accomplishment needs to be your new habit. You need to make it a goal during every single working period. Not that you set aside time to work, but that you work to accomplish the right things. 2. Reevaluate efficiency. Knowing the right result to aim for is honestly half the battle. If you started working toward completing one ideal result for every working period and you did it consistently for the next 3 weeks, I think you'd be shocked to see how much progress you made. But there's something you can do to push this a little further, a little faster. Frankly, I don't know anyone working their way toward a goal who wouldn't love to get there ahead of schedule. So once you've got a clear mile marker in your future and you know the best results to aim for to get closer to it, the next question you want to ask yourself is there something I could be doing that would make this more efficient? If you want to dive into this question in detail, I highly recommend the book, The One Thing by Gary Keller. In it, Keller asks a profound question. Not profound in its complexity, but profound in the sense that most of us are often so busy working inside our goals that we never take the time to work on our goals. The question is basically, what's the one thing you could do right now, today, that would make everything else unnecessary? When it comes to your results list, the question should be, what's the one thing I could do right now, today, that would help me achieve all of this faster, easier, more efficiently? For instance, let's go back to my ideal result of hitting 2,500 words. I ask myself how I could get to my daily word count more efficiently, with less hassle, quicker. The answer was pretty simple and incredibly easy to implement. But if I hadn't asked the question, I absolutely wouldn't have considered it. For me, it's about writing at a coffee house. What's so special about a coffee house? Well, I have a great office with a nice desk and a good chair and access to snacks and water and bathrooms at no additional charge. And I've been writing this book for weeks during my regular office hours. But you know what else is in that office? 14 employees who are working on various projects that I always get pulled into. Now, just so we're clear, they're not the ones pulling me into the projects. In fact, they don't bother me at all because they know I'm on deadline. But writing is a hard and lonely slog. No matter how many times I do it, it always sucks. And when I'm at work and feeling lonely or tired of writing a paragraph, I wander out to use the restroom, and along the way, I find three things to stick my nose into rather than heading back to work. So 2,500 words, which should never take me more than 3 hours, ends up taking the better part of a day. I was still achieving my end result, so I wasn't keen on challenging anything, but I had to ask myself, is there a better way to do this? For me, that means working away from my staff. I like coffee houses better than working from home because there's always great energy from fellow hustlers and creators, and sometimes I even get ideas for chapters, like the start of this one. Working on this book at a coffee house means that I'm plowing through this manuscript, doing way more than 2,500 words at a time, and getting there faster than I was. If you don't ask yourself, if you don't challenge what is and isn't working, then you'll never know. 3. Create your own productive environment. Years ago, someone I admired asked me if I could advise him on the writing process. This person was an extremely talented and sought-after speaker, but he had never written a book. I thought we'd get into word counts or plot points or how to craft an outline, but he really only wanted to know one thing. How do you create a writing retreat in your home to create the perfect atmosphere for writing? You don't, I told him. You write wherever, whenever, however you can. Creating the perfect office won't actually help you in any way. He didn't like my answer. He was adamant that if he could only set up the ideal space, then the process that had proven so hard in the past would become easier. I knew right then he'd never finish a manuscript. That sounds super harsh and catty, but it's the truth. This is based on my years of getting hundreds of questions just like this one. A writing room is dreamy and a luxury I hope to achieve one day, but it doesn't help you write. That's like thinking an expensive treadmill will motivate you to run. No outside factor is going to make you more productive. And if you need a certain atmosphere to be at your best, you're not truly in control of yourself. I'm writing this sentence right now in the center seat on a packed flight. A last-minute speaking gig across the country means all the fancy seats on the plane were booked. But even though it's uncomfortable, I can't miss out on valuable writing time. Early in the morning, late at night, while my kids play in front of me at the park or at soccer practice, I write whenever, however I can. Is one space, like that hipster coffee shop or a mansion overlooking the water, more preferable? Certainly. But life doesn't work like that. If I waited for the perfect space or opportunity to be productive, I wouldn't ever have completed even one of my books. The key is to create an environment that can get you into the zone wherever you happen to be. For me, it's different kinds of playlists, or a certain song played on repeat over and over and over like white noise that helps me focus and get into production mode, even in the most hectic of places. For you, it could be a certain smell, a certain type of gum you chew. No, this is not crazy. The same exact coffee order at Starbucks. Any kind of repetitious cue you can give your brain that it's time to focus. My personal favorite zone maker is an espresso con panna and the song Humble, as loud as my AirPods will allow. In fact, it may scandalize my conservative listeners to know that most of Girl Wash Your Face was written to Kendrick Lamar on repeat. But hey, when you find out what helps you get into the zone, you capitalize on it as much as you can. 4. Know what distracts you and avoid that thing. Man, this sounds obvious when you write it out, but people who struggle to be or stay productive are usually too distracted to know they're distracted. Every time your focus and your energy wander, it takes a long time to get them back, if you even get them back at all. Pay attention to what steals your attention. For me, it's usually access to Wi-Fi on my computer and the ability to see or hear the home screen of my phone. In my mind, every text is urgent and possibly an employee telling me that the office is burning down. Every incoming email might be from Oprah. And a quick Google search to research something I'm writing about turns into a vortex rabbit hole, and suddenly I find myself taking a BuzzFeed quiz to see who my ideal Disney prince might be. So guess what has to happen when I'm trying to hit a certain word count? I have to shut off my Wi-Fi, flip my phone over, and turn the sound off so I don't see or hear any incoming messages. 5. Course correct. It's easy to get sidetracked, and it's even easier to be moving so quickly in a direction that you don't realize it's the wrong direction. I recommend a check-in with yourself every Sunday. Sunday is the easiest time for me because it's when I plan out my week. I take the time to focus in on the outcome I want for the week and then ask myself if I'm really, truly headed in the direction of the next mile marker. If so, great. If not, what can I do this week to ensure that I get the results I'm looking for? When it comes to efficiency, the bottom line is this: you're already doing the work. You're already putting in the time, and it would be such a waste if you were depleting your energy for no reason, or worse, potentially giving up on a great idea simply because you haven't figured out how to make greater strides toward your goal. Do an efficiency audit and figure out where you need to tighten up and shift your focus. Skill 5, positivity. I once lived through 52 hours of labor. 50 freaking 2 hours. I will never let my firstborn forget about this as long as I live. In fact, even after I'm gone, I'm planning to arrange it so someone sends him an occasional reminder of this fact, like those men who pay a florist to deliver flowers every year on their wife's birthday even after they're dead. Anyway, it was the worst. It was so hard and exhausting and painful, and the nurses only let me have popsicles or jello or chicken broth during the labor. It took forever to get to the time to push. Anyone who has lived through a similar experience will vouch for me. You wait and wait and wait, and just when it seems like you'll probably just stay pregnant forever, they announce that it's time to push. Time to push. For me, the time to push came so much later than anticipated that the epidural had started to wear off. Yes, epidural. You didn't think I went through 2 days of labor without drugs, did you? No, I am not that heroic. I utilized the anesthesiologist who, just so we're clear,